Lady Glyde's recollection of the events which followed her departure from Blackwater Park began with her arrival at the London terminus of the South Western Railway. She had omitted to make a memorandum beforehand of the day on which she took the journey. All hope of fixing that important date by any evidence of hers or of Mrs. Mitchelson's must be given up for lost. On the arrival of the train at the platform, Lady Glyde found Count Fosco waiting for her. He was at the carriage door as soon as the porter could open it. The train was unusually crowded, and there was great confusion in getting the luggage. Some person whom Count Fosco brought with him procured the luggage which belonged to Lady Glyde. It was marked with her name. She drove away alone with the Count in a vehicle which she did not particularly notice at the time. Her first question on leaving the terminus referred to Miss Holcombe. The Count informed her that Miss Holcombe had not yet gone to Cumberland, after consideration having caused him to doubt the prudence of her taking so long a journey without some days' previous rest. Lady Glyde next inquired whether her sister was then staying in the Count's house. Her recollection of the answer was confused, her only distinct impression in relation to it being that the Count declared he was then taking her to see Miss Holcombe. Lady Glyde's experience of London was so limited that she could not tell at the time through what streets they were driving. But they never left the streets, and they never passed any gardens or trees. When the carriage stopped, it stopped in a small street behind a square in which there were shops and public buildings and many people. From these recollections, of which Lady Glyde was certain, it seems quite clear that Count Fosco did not take her to his own residence in the suburb of St. John's Wood. They entered the house and went upstairs to a back room, either on the first or second floor. The luggage was carefully brought in. A female servant opened the door, and a man with a dark beard, apparently a foreigner, met them in the hall, and with great politeness showed them the way upstairs. In answer to Lady Glyde's inquiries, the Count assured her that Miss Holcombe was in the house, and that she should be immediately informed of her sister's arrival. He and the foreigner then went away, and left her by herself in the room. It was poorly furnished as a sitting room, and it looked out on the backs of houses. The place was remarkably quiet. No footsteps went up or down the stairs. She only heard in the room beneath her a dull, rumbling sound of men's voices talking. Before she had been long left alone, the Count returned to explain that Miss Holcombe was then taking rest and could not be disturbed for a little while. He was accompanied into the room by a gentleman, an Englishman, whom he begged to present as a friend of his. After this singular introduction, in the course of which no names to the best of Lady Glyde's recollection had been mentioned, she was left alone with the stranger. He was perfectly civil, but he startled and confused her by some odd questions about herself, and by looking at her, while he asked them, in a strange manner. After remaining a short time, he went out, and a minute or two afterwards a second stranger, also an Englishman, came in. This person introduced himself as another friend of Count Fosco's, and he, in his turn, looked at her very oddly and asked some curious questions, never, as well as she could remember, addressing her by name, and going out again after a little while, like the first man. By this time she was so frightened about herself, and so uneasy about her sister, that she had thoughts of venturing downstairs again, and claiming the protection and assistance of the only woman she had seen in the house, the servant who answered the door. Just as she had risen from her chair, the Count came back into the room. The moment he appeared, she asked anxiously how long the meeting between her sister and herself was to be still delayed. At first, he returned an evasive answer, but on being pressed, he acknowledged with great apparent reluctance that Miss Holcombe was by no means so well as he had hitherto represented her to be. His tone and manner in making this reply so alarmed Lady Glyde, or rather so painfully increased the uneasiness which she had felt in the company of the two strangers, that a sudden faintness overcame her, and she was obliged to ask for a glass of water. The Count called from the door for water, and for a bottle of smelling salts. Both were brought in by the foreign-looking man with the beard. The water, when Lady Glyde attempted to drink it, had so strange a taste that it increased her faintness, and she hastily took the bottle of salts from Count Fosco and smelt at it. Her head became giddy on the instant. The Count caught the bottle as it dropped out of her hand, and the last impression of which she was conscious was that he held it to her nostrils again. From this point, her recollections were found to be confused, fragmentary, and difficult to reconcile with any reasonable probability. Her own impression was that she recovered her senses later in the evening, that she then left the house, that she went, as she had previously arranged to go at Blackwater Park, to Mrs. Vase's, that she drank tea there, and that she passed the night under Mrs. Vase's roof. She was totally unable to say how or when or in what company she left the house to which Count Fosco had brought her. But she persisted in asserting that she had been to Mrs. Vase's, and still more extraordinary, that she had been helped to undress and get to bed by Mrs. Rubell. She could not remember what the conversation was at Mrs. Vase's, or whom she saw there besides that lady, or why Mrs. Rubell should have been present in the house to help her. Her recollection of what happened to her the next morning was still more vague and unreliable. She had some dim idea of driving out, at what hour she could not say, with Count Fosco, and with Mrs. Rubell again, for a female attendant. But when and why she left Mrs. Vase, she could not tell. Neither did she know what direction the carriage drove in, or where it set her down, or whether the Count and Mrs. Rubell did or did not remain with her all the time she was out. At this point in her sad story, there was a total blank. She had no impressions of the faintest kind to communicate, no idea whether one day or more than one day had passed, until she came to herself suddenly in a strange place surrounded by women who were all unknown to her. This was the asylum. Here she first heard herself called by Anne Catherick's name, and here, as a last remarkable circumstance in the story of the conspiracy, her own eyes informed her that she had Anne Catherick's clothes on. The nurse, on the first night in the asylum, had shown her the marks on each article of her underclothing as it was taken off, and had said, not at all irritably or unkindly, "Look at your own name on your own clothes, and don't worry us all any more about being Lady Glyde. She's dead and buried, and you're alive and hearty. Do look at your clothes now. There it is, in good marking ink. And there you will find it on all your old things, which we have kept in the house. Anne Catherick, as plain as print." And there it was, when Miss Holcombe examined the linen her sister wore on the night of their arrival at Limeridge House. These were the only recollections, all of them uncertain and some of them contradictory, which could be extracted from Lady Glyde by careful questioning on the journey to Cumberland. Miss Holcombe abstained from pressing her with any inquiries relating to events in the asylum, her mind being but too evidently unfit to bear the trial of reverting to them. It was known by the voluntary admission of the owner of the madhouse that she was received there on the 27th of July. From that date until the 15th of October, the day of her rescue, she had been under restraint. Her identity with Anne Catherick systematically asserted, and her sanity, from first to last, practically denied. Faculties less delicately balanced, constitutions less tenderly organized, must have suffered under such an ordeal as this. No man could have gone through it and come out of it unchanged. Arriving at Limeridge late on the evening of the 15th, Miss Holcombe wisely resolved not to attempt the assertion of Lady Glyde's identity until the next day. The first thing in the morning she went to Mr. Fairley's room, and, using all possible cautions and preparations beforehand, at last told him, in so many words, what had happened. As soon as his first astonishment and alarm had subsided, he angrily declared that Miss Holcombe had allowed herself to be duped by Anne Catherick. He referred her to Count Fosco's letter, and to what she had herself told him of the personal resemblance between Anne and his deceased niece. And he positively declined to admit to his presence, even for one minute only, a madwoman whom it was an insult and an outrage to have brought into his house at all. Miss Holcombe left the room, waited till the first heat of her indignation had passed away, decided on reflection that Mr. Fairley should see his niece, in the interests of common humanity, before he closed his doors on her as a stranger, and thereupon, without a word of previous warning, took Lady Glyde with her to his room. The servant was posted at the door to prevent their entrance, but Miss Holcombe insisted on passing him, and made her way into Mr. Fairley's presence, leading her sister by the hand. The scene that followed, though it only lasted for a few minutes, was too painful to be described. Miss Holcombe herself shrank from referring to it. Let it be enough to say that Mr. Fairley declared in the most positive terms that he did not recognize the woman who had been brought into his room, that he saw nothing in her face and manner to make him doubt for a moment that his niece lay buried in Limeridge churchyard, and that he would call on the law to protect him if before the day was over she was not removed from the house. Taking the very worst view of Mr. Fairley's selfishness, indolence, and habitual want of feeling, it was manifestly impossible to suppose that he was capable of such infamy as secretly recognizing and openly disowning his brother's child. Miss Holcombe humanely and sensibly allowed all due force to the influence of prejudice and alarm in preventing him from fairly exercising his perceptions, and accounted for what had happened in that way. But when she next put the servants to the test, and found that they too were in every case uncertain, to say the least of it, whether the lady presented to them was their young mistress or Anne Catherick, of whose resemblance to her they had all heard, the sad conclusion was inevitable, that the change produced in Lady Glyde's face and manner by her imprisonment in the asylum was far more serious than Miss Holcombe had at first supposed. The vile deception which had asserted her death defied exposure even in the house where she was born and among the people with whom she had lived. In a less critical situation, the effort need not have been given up as hopeless even yet. For example, the maid, Fanny, who happened to be then absent from Limeridge, was expected back in 2 days, and there would be a chance of gaining her recognition to start with, seeing that she had been in much more constant communication with her mistress and had been much more heartily attached to her than the other servants. Again, Lady Glyde might have been privately kept in the house or in the village to wait until her health was a little recovered and her mind was a little steadied again. When her memory could be once more trusted to serve her, she would naturally refer to persons and events in the past with a certainty and a familiarity which no impostor could simulate, and so the fact of her identity, which her own appearance had failed to establish, might subsequently be proved, with time to help her, by the surer test of her own words. But the circumstances under which she had regained her freedom rendered all recourse to such means as these simply impracticable. The pursuit from the asylum, diverted to Hampshire for the time only, would infallibly next take the direction of Cumberland. The persons appointed to seek the fugitive might arrive at Limeridge House at a few hours' notice, and in Mr. Fairley's present temper of mind, they might count on the immediate exertion of his local influence and authority to assist them. The commonest consideration for Lady Glyde's safety forced on Miss Holcombe the necessity of resigning the struggle to do her justice, and of removing her at once from the place of all others that was now most dangerous to her, the neighbourhood of her own home. An immediate return to London was the first and wisest measure of security which suggested itself. In the great city, all traces of them might be most speedily and most surely effaced. There were no preparations to make, no farewell words of kindness to exchange with anyone. On the afternoon of that memorable day of the 16th, Miss Holcombe roused her sister to a last exertion of courage, and, without a living soul to wish them well at parting, the two took their way into the world alone, and turned their backs forever on Limeridge House. They had passed the hill above the churchyard when Lady Glyde insisted on turning back to look her last at her mother's grave. Miss Holcombe tried to shake her resolution, but in this one instance tried in vain. She was immovable. her dim eyes lit with a sudden fire and flash through the veil that hung over them. Her wasted fingers strengthened moment by moment round the friendly arm by which they had held so listlessly till this time. I believe in my soul that the hand of God was pointing their way back to them, and that the most innocent and the most afflicted of his creatures was chosen in that dread moment to see it. They retraced their steps to the burial ground, and by that act sealed the future of our three lives.